Welcome back to Leads to Scale, a podcast from Social Media Week. I am your host, Toby Daniels. On this week's episode, we have Robert Harles, Managing Director, Global Lead, Social Media and Emerging Channels at Accenture Interactive. As I mentioned at the top of the episode, I've known Rob for over 10 years and have always been interested in his career path, where he has held senior positions at a number of major global organizations, including Sears, Comscore, Bloomberg, and now Accenture Interactive. During the conversation, we discussed his early days in management consulting and how it helped to shape and define his career, his experience working with some of the biggest brands in the world, focusing on social media and enterprise collaboration. And we also spent some time talking about his current role at Accenture, their recent acquisition of Droga5, and how having one of the most respected creative agencies in the world will shape their business going forward. Also, while I have you, if you're interested in hearing when new episodes drop, or if you want to keep up to date with Social Media Week news, then why not give old Toby D a follow on the Twitter, at Toby D. That's T-O-B-Y-D. And as always, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Leads to Scale on your favorite podcasting app. And I hope you enjoy the conversation. Robert Harles, welcome. Thanks for joining the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Rob, we've known each other for, I believe, the best part of 10 years. And this is the first time, I believe, that we have had the opportunity to like have a proper one-to-one sit-down conversation while, of course, simultaneously being recorded. So in preparation, I sort of did a little bit of research. I did some homework, and I discovered that first of all, you're based in Chicago. You're from America, but you did your undergraduate and your master's degrees at Oxford University. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. The one thing you needed to know is if you're at Oxford and you get your undergraduate and you don't go to jail in the next like 3 or 4 years, they actually grant you your master's degree. So it's a nice thing to have, having to go through a few years and then be able to say that, I have a master's degree.
Wow. So. Amazing. I have no idea what any of that really means. I'd love to take the time to dig in, but unfortunately we don't have that time. So, well, listen, from my perspective, this makes you an honorary Brit, which is probably the reason why I like you so much, but I'm sort of curious, you know, you obviously, as a young man, you sort of decided to go to the UK and study. I'm just curious, what was that experience like?
It was extremely different, as you could imagine. And the reason I got there was because my brother, he's about 8 years older than I am. He actually earned his master's degree and his doctorate at Oxford. And I followed suit and just fell in love with the place because I liked history, and particularly architectural history. And so I went there, and it dates me a bit, but when I was there, it was a very different place than it is now. The UK was a very different place. I still remember that the shops would close noon for lunch. They would do that. Or that you could get a phone installed in your house, but you could have it only a dial in, not dial out, and things like that. Not to mention, most towns are a little more quaint. They didn't have as many high street shops and brands. They were still sort of a nation of shopkeepers, and with quite quaint customs sometimes. And it in a very short period of time, it changed very quickly.
Certainly did. Well, I have history with Cambridge University. Unfortunately, I didn't manage to go there. But my grandfather double majored in theology and physics at Cambridge University, and also two of my uncles also went to Cambridge, and so of course, you know, there is a historical event that takes place every year between Oxford and Cambridge, the boat race.
That's right.
And so for many years, I was always able to back a team. So now I have a real rival, to pitch up against the next time.
Well, oddly enough, we're going to the boat race dinner here in Chicago as part of the Alumni Association. So the Cambridge crew, I think, won this year. They're going to be there.
Of course, they win every year.
Yeah, I'm sure they do, you know, because they cheat.
Absolutely. Well, so okay. So you had you spent some time, 3+ years or so, in the UK. What brought you back stateside? And just, you know, share a little bit of background for our listeners in terms of kind of like, you know, what was your sort of like initial foray into the business world once you had graduated from Oxford?
Well, and I actually spent the number 10 is coming up a lot. So one thing I wanted to tell you is that our relationship is about as old as my marriage right now. So 10. And actually, I spent about 10 years in the UK. So I did my A-levels too. So it, what brought me back was that after university, I had gotten involved with the business club because I was actually afraid that I would be completely unemployable with a modern European history degree. I was organizing events as part of that for undergraduates, where they, you know, you'd introduce them to potential employers, might have been investment banks or accounting firms or whatever. And one of them was McKinsey. I'd done this for a series of terms where I would introduce, you know, we'd set up these events and they would come and people would socialize and they would get to know one another. And, you know, one thing, if you know anything about Oxford and Cambridge, most people don't specialize in a vocation. They specialize in something that's interesting. So if you, to them, so if you're modern European history, that's what you do for 3.5 or 4 years. And then you go off and become an accountant. So I was hoping that that might apply to me too, not necessarily becoming an accountant. But at one point, McKinsey had said, hey, you organize all these events for us and you do a great job. Why don't you apply? And I had to admit, like I would organize these events and then I'd probably tune out as to what they actually did. So I said, well, why not? And one thing led to another. And after about 12 interviews, I ended up having an offer from McKinsey.
I'm sure you're what you weren't the first history graduate from the University of Oxford who was employed by McKinsey. I mean, I think that's like ultimately who they're scouting for at the end of the day.
Yeah, they do. I mean, that was a great thing about that company because, and still true today, is they have a diversified hire program and they deliberately went beyond business school MBAs to get people who have, you know, doctorates or master's degrees in history or English literature or classics or law or politics, philosophy, and economics on the basis that they were just looking for people who thought a little differently and could problem solve.
Exactly. Well, I've met a bunch of people who at least in the early stage of their career went to like a red brick university, went into management consulting or something kind of similar to that. And even if they only stuck with it for the first few years, it was like foundational. It like really laid out kind of some of the most important fundamentals of what they needed in terms of like the building blocks of a great career. Like, what was your experience like at McKinsey and how did it define your career in the early days?
One, it's great because if you know anything about McKinsey, again, they're a very, it's almost a little bit like Oxford. It's a very collegial kind of place where people almost come to learn about business, right? But they also are very usually very bright people who come together and they're great problem solvers. And McKinsey has all these programs set up to train people. And particularly if you didn't have an MBA, they have this crash course called the mini MBA. And you would go to someplace exotic like Vevey, Switzerland, but in my case, it was Clearwater, Florida, and spend, you know, a few weeks with peers from across the globe and learn everything you wanted to know about net present values and things like that. It was really great that I did it because if you didn't know a thing about what you wanted to do and you didn't know much about business and you hadn't got an MBA, then I can't think of a better company to work for because they actually paid you to learn all of that. And then the other part was that you got to sample a lot of different industries and problems and that sort of thing. I wouldn't say that I was the best consultant ever. I was probably pretty terrible, but at the end of the day, it was the people that you worked with were amazing. The client work was typically very good, but there I remember distinctly that they would place you into projects for the first year or so, and they would ask you like, what are you interested in? And you'd always be tipped off by your peers in that first year saying, well, whatever you say, just don't say you want to do, you know, insurance, or don't say you want to do something else. And I remembering that and in the conversation with the career advisor saying, well, I'm interested in all these things, technology and marketing and I'm interested maybe in looking at retail, something like that. And then they said, okay, well, but what are you not really interested in? And I said, well, I one thing I really wouldn't want to do is financial services, and you know, in particular, I really wouldn't want to do property casualty insurance. So so that they said, great. And then phone rang a couple weeks later and they said, hey, we've got a great opportunity for you to go and work on a client project. And I said, fantastic. Where is it? And they said, oh, it's going to be Allstate. and I kid you not, it was really great. I mean, the people were fantastic. We worked on a project. I never knew, you know, that I could do some of the things that you ended up doing. And it was very successful. And I did a few stints there. And after that was done, I had another call and they said, well, now that you know, you had a really great experience at this insurance company, why, you know, what would you like to do next? And I said, well, I'd like to do technology or marketing or, you know, something like that. I'd even take financial services again. That was really good. And they said, okay, great. What do you not want to do? And I said, well, you know, I've been tipped off again that you really probably don't want to do something in, I don't know, chemicals and biotechnology. And so I said, okay, fine. That's great. We'll get back to you in a few days. And the phone rang again. And I said, okay, we've got a great opportunity for you. And I said, well, what is it? And they said, well, there's this client called Monsanto that is really doing some very interesting things. And we think you have a perfect fit for that. And in truth, that was also really interesting. After all of that, I was ending up working with some researchers that were trying to figure out how to innovate better than they were doing before.
You know, I think that like Tom Cruise probably went through a similar sort of experience in like the 80s and 90s when he was just like typecast in like basically the same role over and over again. It sounds like you experienced something similar at McKinsey.
Right. So they forced you out of your comfort zone, which was the great thing about McKinsey. And I think those stories and the people and relationships that you form, you never lose, right?
Right, totally. And it also, I mean, presumably, it gave you the confidence to enter into the startup world because you know you made a relatively quick foray into the startup world. You know, in the like what early to mid 2000s. I mean, that must have been
a sweet spot.
Yeah. Fascinating and turbulent time. But what was the big idea? Like, what was the motivation to get into that kind of world? And how was that experience?
Well, it was definitely an exciting time. I'm glad I did it. And it was interesting because we were at McKinsey and my friends and I were talking about different things that we wanted to do. And, you know, at some point you were thinking, well, wow, am I really working on things for clients here? Or am I trying to do a startup? And one thing led to another. And we started talking about some of the opportunities to take some of the new sort of channel work that we were doing in financial services at the time, you know, electronic forms of payment and all that kind of stuff. And we're thinking, wow, you know, maybe we could create some sort of web community around that. it was funny because you talk to people who are very, very smart, but at the time you had no real idea where this was headed and what it meant and what success looked like. And you would ask for advice and they, you know, very senior people would say, well, it's all about eyeballs or it's all about stickiness or it's all about something. And you're like, great, that's all we need to do. We need to get some sort of website and we'll make it sticky and we'll get a lot of eyeballs, but not a lot of ideas about how you get all that done and what you're trying to drive towards and what the value of all of it is. But the long story short was we hit upon some idea where, which is actually coming to fruition now. And we were kind of the first little group to come together with using different technologies like Ajax at the time to create a more interactive experience while people were on the web. So we weren't flat pages, wasn't just basic HTML. We were using, really dynamic interactions. And we thought, you know, everybody is starting to get into financial services about planning for wealth management. All they're very, very complex. What if we broke it down into little, we call them super duper calculators that could answer a discrete question, almost as a digital advisor might. And we started creating these things. And oddly enough, we were able to get a number of clients that paid us several $1 million for that. But they, you know, the idea was that you could come in and ask a discrete question like, do I need life insurance? Rather than, you know, here's a life insurance calculator. You know, just ask a free form question and get some additional you know, background and back and forth from the agent itself, this digital agent. And then it might tell you, well, no, actually, you probably don't need it right now because you're single and you're just starting out. But you might need something else. And we created it so that if you came in another time to ask another discrete question, it remembered you and remembered everything that you told it. So you didn't only have to ask maybe two or three questions to help someone find out, you know, whether they could afford a mortgage.
Ajax, though, I want to just like just pause for a second, because like that was just like such a breakthrough technology. I mean,
it was.
The idea of being able to refresh something within a page without the page having to refresh just
right. Sounds
kind of, you know, really rudimentary when you sort of talk about it right now. But at the time, that was what was like holding back the web experience, was this idea that like page load times were just like not particularly fast. Even, you know, in that sort of during that advent of like high speed broadband, it was still kind of slow and pedestrian. And then all of a sudden there was this like technology that just like just changed the game.
And I remember, well, you remember you're talking to a historian. So this is someone whose native language has nothing to do with technology whatsoever. but, you know, we found some really great people who, and there were very few who knew what to do there with either SQL queries or Ajax or anything else. And we found a couple of the best people, and they were amazing. Like you find these people, they're savants, right?
Yeah.
And they just, they can talk to you for hours, and it's inspirational. So one thing led to another, and we ended up creating that, and we got some investment from some McKinsey partners, and it was going gangbusters. And I always joke, we kind of sold it just in time. It's one of those things where it didn't go viral. It didn't, you know, go public. And we hit the bubble just at the time. It was just about to burst, and we were about to get our Series B financing, and it dried up, and so we ended up having to kind of sell it off. But it was fun. It was one of those things you never forget. It sort of builds camaraderie with a group of, you know, young people just hanging out together and thinking about how they can change the world. And that's the thing that I hope, you know, never to lose track of, because those moments, I always talk about them now as we talk about those moments that matter,
right?
Started then.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's been with me ever since.
Totally. Wait, just remind me, what was the exact time frame, the years where you were building that?
That was probably about, I would say it was 98, 99 through about 2001.
Right.
God. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just such a fascinating period of time. It really was. I mean, that was sort of my sort of entry into the world of the internet and building websites for the entertainment industry was sort of around that sort of period of time. And it was fascinating, and it was turbulent, but it was exciting at the same time. And of course, you know, so much of what we were working on and the ideas that we were sort of thinking about that back then were, as I mentioned, like foundational to kind of like, you know, some of the things that we're working on today, even though it's like 10, 15, almost 20 years later. It's super interesting. So, so let's like fast forward a little bit, because, you know, when I sort of look at the arc of your career and the positions you've held and the companies that you've been at, you know, you've held some pretty impressive and senior positions at some major global organizations, you know, over the course of like, you know, the next 10 years plus that, you know, following kind of your experience at your startup. So, you know, you're at Sears, you're at Comscore, Bloomberg, and now you're at Accenture. And throughout that period, you've always seemed to kind of sort of, well, you've always been focused on digital. That's, you know, a given. But you've also sort of maintained this focus on social media and, you know, more recently on sort of like, you know, enterprise collaboration. And I'm sort of interested because of how early you saw it and could see the sort of the promise and potential of social media, I'm curious to know, like, what drew you into that specific aspect of like digital? What what's kept you focused and what's kept you sort of engaged in this particular area? And obviously, you know, how have you seen it evolve over that time?
Well, I think I've always, or I certainly developed a fine appreciation of technology as I, you know, went through my various incarnations. And always, I think maybe part of it was just the communities that you go through, the people that you get to work with and how they constantly are never satisfied with the way the world is in some fashion. And there's always, it's a genuine thing that I think the people who have created what we now call social media, I mean, they, I think they genuinely, you know, really wanted to make a big difference, a positive big difference. You know, it's kind of our summer of love, right? You know, we didn't go to Woodstock. We got started coding and learning C++ and all that kind of stuff because we thought, hey, this is a way to make the world a better place, more democratic, more egalitarian, more creative, you know, more equal. And I think, you know, whether you look at Mark Zuckerberg or anybody else, I think that's, I genuinely think that they have that, you know, that's what motivated them and got them excited over time. And you know, just even meeting some of these folks early on in their careers, when you're like, Facebook, I don't know what this, I don't think that's gonna be around very long, but yeah, it looks pretty interesting. You know, it's just fascinating to see how these things started off small ideas, creative thought processes put in place to problem solve, as we said before. And then they've kind of, what I find particularly interesting, and this goes back to my historian roots, was it's just, you know, being able to use these technologies in many ways this sounds odd, but to humanize our progression towards a more technological future. And that sounds strange, but I think that a lot of the impetus behind these changes and innovations have been focused on that core need to storytell, or to make a connection with someone, or to get feedback, or to solve a problem that maybe would have taken, you know, weeks or years to solve, or, you know, to, and that's a very different process, I think, than, you know, if you go again, historical hat, the Industrial Revolution, and then the digital revolution, and you know, the corporate revolution and the commercial revolution, all those kinds of things. They were all about really kind of how to grapple with scale.
Right. And which is, we always like when people mention the word scale on the Leads to Scale podcast. But I think you're touching on so many interesting things here, because I mean, I've got a few different questions that I want to ask as a follow-up, but you know, when you think about sort of this most recent revolution, I suppose, that we are experiencing, and I think, you know, it's difficult necessarily to kind of put a specific label on it, but whatever, the communications revolution, whatever. You know, there's sort of this idea that we're sort of all guided by sort of entirely idealistic tendencies or impulses or desires, or that when we think about the future and the opportunity that this technology sort of affords us, that we're just simply going to go after ideas and opportunities that are going to impact the world in positive ways. But the truth is, that's just not like the way that humans are.
No.
And what we see today as a manifestation of like that opportunity is really complicated. And there are some beautiful, amazing, extraordinary sort of aspects to it and examples of how I think it's fulfilled on a lot of what you're talking about. But obviously and equally, there are examples of how it's perhaps introduced something negative and concerning and problematic for us as a society. And it always seems to be simultaneously both, because, you know, we're a complex species and we don't necessarily sort of all want the same things. We're not all guided by the same principles. What's your sort of like, you know, take on kind of where we are today? Because it does feel like we're a little bit of an inflection point, right?
Yeah, I know, I agree. And again, it you always see these inflection points in history, right? When some new thing has occurred that could be groundbreaking and fantastic, and maybe splitting the atom would be one of them. And there's a inflection point or a stage gate which says we can go one way or we can go the other. We can use this for good, or we could really just descend into something terrible. And that, you know, any innovation has always been thus, right? And many innovations, I think, have come from the darker side of our humanity, And then somehow we've managed, hopefully as a positive aspect of them, to emerge on the other side with a better sense of perspective and how these things that could be terrible could be turned into things for good. And I think we're at that same point, which is, we've kind of gone through almost a curve, and we're still on a trajectory of not knowing exactly where this is going to lead. My concern right now is less about the technology itself. It's more about us ensuring that our humanity remains intact and is applied to whatever we create. And remember, this got me thinking about it, and this was a few years ago when we had a breakfast with Tim Urban, right? And yeah, and that was amazing. I think I my jaw dropped after that breakfast. It was the best breakfast I've ever had. And I don't eat breakfast, but this was great. And it was both exhilarating and frightening at the same time, because he understands where technology can go, particularly in terms of artificial intelligence and so forth. And I just, that really hammered it home for me, and has influenced me ever since in terms of how I, as a technologist, as a consultant, as a business person, think about the ethics of what we do day to day. And I think right now that inflection point for me is that we need to make sure that we're getting out in front of the things that we're creating versus waiting for and reacting to what's coming out of the things we've created. And that's the biggest challenge I think we're all going to have, which is, the obvious ones, which are privacy and, security and democracy and truth and trust. And how do all of these things, how do we preserve those, the best of those things, when the things we're creating right now could be argued are sort of a solvent against all of that? And so that's, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of the way I think about where we are right now. We have to start thinking, coming together and being very, very thoughtful, and maybe putting down our competitiveness and our suspiciousness and mistrust, and do that globally, very quickly, to make sure that the genie that we've released from this bottle is going to be a benevolent one.
I mean, there's so much in there. I mean, I want to go back to the Tim Urban conversation just for the listeners' benefit. So, Tim, he has a blog, and it honestly, describing it as a blog does it like a little bit of a disservice. It's one of my most favorite places to go and learn and to go very deep into a lot of his incredible work. But Tim's site is waitbutwhy.com. It's incredible. He basically only publishes a handful of articles a year. And the reason for that is because he just goes so deep into a particular subject. If you really want to go deep into a particular subject that is obviously on top of a lot of people's minds at the moment, which is AI, The Road to Superintelligence is the piece that he wrote, that he spoke about at the breakfast that we put together, 3 years ago now. It's kind of amazing to think how long ago that was and how much has happened since then. But I agree, it was a fascinating kind of conversation for sure. And so the other couple of other things you sort of touched on, sort of, the human first kind of piece to the equation, when we think about the future and we think about the sort of the path forward. And I'm sort of, I hear from you why this matters from a sort of personal perspective, given, obviously, how deep you are in the weeds on a lot of this stuff at a professional level, but also I'm sure you're thinking about this in terms of, the broader implications of society and the broader implications for humanity, your own family, your own kids, et cetera, et cetera. I'm curious though, and I want to sort of use this opportunity as a sort of like a segue to talking about what you're focused on right now at Accenture, but how much of what you do professionally impacts how you think about these things personally?
I mean, almost every day, and increasingly so. Most of my days are filled with, obviously trying to answer discrete questions and help brands and other institutions figure out how to use these technologies and tools more effectively. And that's a very generic and sanitized way of saying, you know, we help people, you know, get to grips with these changes that are occurring all over the world. We help brands hopefully use them in the right way. But there isn't a day that goes by when we, you know, we don't have to think about what's appropriate and what isn't. And there is no roadmap at this point. It's something that hopefully is ingrained in the morality of the people that you surround yourself with and work with every day. So, you know, at one level, we're helping people, say marketers, brand marketers, interact with, understand, and communicate better with their customers. Well, that sounds great. But this thing I said before, which is this idea of focusing on the moments that matter, that really, that came out of this idea that, you know, as marketers or as technologists or as business leaders, we get further, we can get further and further and further away from our understanding our customers truly and appreciating them. And we can use these tools that we've got to bombard people with things or invade their privacy if we're not careful, in a way that's inappropriate, or we can use them as a way to hopefully bring the humanity back, right? We always talk about this thing about it, sometimes it's back to the future, which is where I think we want to go, which is, you know, being that nation of shopkeepers where you knew 100 people and you really cared about them and they knew you, they, that you cared about them, and, you know, you could personalize things for them and their family. You could hold things back or get something ordered special, or you could ask them about what's going on with their lives. And now I think, having gone through a you know, almost a century of scale where we've lost touch and gotten further and further away from our understanding our customers, or understanding our, and applying our humanity, we actually have an opportunity to use these tools to get back to that, you know, to take scale and make it feel much more intimate.
You know, it's so interesting because I think that Facebook's most recent announcements, And also sort of like, you know, admission, like personal admission from Mark Zuckerberg's perspective, when he sort of came out and said, look, we've been building towards open and connected, because that was even a philosophical level, this sort of idea that that would create the type of positive impact that we ultimately wanted to see in the world. And, you know, we've come to this sort of conclusion that that's not necessarily what people want or need. Or at least it's not just only about that. Like, if we make people more open, does it really make them feel more connected? And I think if that's the kind of the hypothesis, the answer to the hypothesis is like no, or at least not necessarily. And the shift that they're making now into, and I don't think it's like a pendulum shift, I just think it's a kind of like, okay, let's now put a bunch of resource behind this like other hypothesis, which is people want to communicate in safe, private, secure, and not wanting to be overly technological, but like, you know, encrypted environments where they feel comfortable and they feel they can communicate in ways that are not going to be exploited for commercial purposes. And I think that's a really, you know, if you just think about everything that you just said, and then you think about it in the context of what Facebook's building and what Facebook is focusing on, you can see that that shift is represented in, you know, in what people ultimately are asking for from a lot of these tech platforms.
Well, I mean, it's absolutely spot on. I kind of boil it down to, hopefully not too simplistic a concept, but it's really what people are looking for is trust. I mean, that's what we do as humans. We couldn't function as we, you know, climbed out of the trees and started congregating in larger and larger groups. We couldn't have functioned if we hadn't figured out ways to help each other trust one another, right? Whether those are, you know, laws, which, you know, hopefully are put in place that are equitable and fair and protect, or they're sort of social understandings, like, you know, I don't mean you any harm, and you know that. And we've built, you know, whole realms of expression and ability to communicate, to express that and communicate those feelings of hopefully openness and and trust. And when those break down, that's when we've gotten into serious conflict. Same thing as digital, right? And that's the thing right now that I think we're wrestling with, which is as open as we've become, it's also opened up the floodgates in terms of diluting things that are important, like trust. And the more examples that proliferate around the idea of not knowing if something's real or fake or honest or false or benevolent or malevolent, those things amplify, particularly on the internet, where now we can reach millions of people, but it only takes a few seconds and people can pass this along very quickly, whereas we had a natural buffer when we didn't have that. Slow to process down.
All right, let's get down to brass tacks, Mr. Halls. Let's talk about Accenture. Let's talk about your current role. You are the managing director, global lead of social media and emerging channels.
That's right.
Talk about your role. What's your current focus?
Well, my role, I came in and I was given the instruction of, we really want to build a capability and practice around social for our customers, our clients, also think about it in terms of not just how do we help them use the platforms better, but how do we take this thing called social or social media and really bake it into the DNA of an organization so that you can create better experiences, full stop. And that's kind of been the guiding light or North Star that Accenture Interactive, Accenture Digital has had for the last 10 years. It's certainly evolved, but the idea being that, if you really want to be a better marketer, if you want to be a better business person, if you want to use technology for good that actually influences, improves people's lives and builds better customer relationships, then think about it almost counterintuitively backwards. What is the experience you want to create? How do you want to reach out to your customers and engage with them in a way that's safe and meaningful and builds trust? How do you, create benefit that turns into true strategic impact and that drives real value? It's not just about engagement or reach. I mean, we've had those conversations till the cows come home in past conversations. But it's true. What you really want to be able to do is sort of how do I build better relationships and communicate that people matter, and how do you use technologies like social to do that, along with improved analytics or applied analytics. How do you use digital marketing in different forms, in different channels, but make it feel like one experience? It doesn't matter to someone, we've talked about this before, whether they're talking to you on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, you name it, or they're in your call center, or they're in your shop, or they're in a group face-to-face. People want to have the same experience. They want to have a projection of whatever your brand promise is expressed truthfully, openly, and transparently, and effectively on whatever means of communication they choose to use. And so that's my broader remit, is to make sure that we don't end up with social media and all the other things that are coming along the pike, the emerging channels pieces, whether that's IoT or AR, VR, you name it, just being orphans. Nifty ideas that are bright and shiny objects that we deploy and spend a lot of money and time on, but then really have no impact.
We interrupt this week's episode of Leads to Scale to share an update in regards to our forthcoming conference in London, the 10th annual edition of Social Media Week London, Europe's premier conference for media and marketing professionals, is taking place at the QE2 Conference Center in Westminster between October 31st and November 1st. This year's event will continue the 2019 global theme Stories with Great Influence Comes Great Responsibility, a conversation that will explore how social media has become the most influential story platform in the world that has the power to both unite and divide us. Check out our first wave of speakers and secure your pass by visiting socialmediaweek.org/London. And don't forget to use the code LEADS2SCALE at the checkout to save an additional 10% off your pass. All right, let's get back to the show. How do you strike the right balance between, you know, investing in the fundamentals of like what technology represents as the greatest opportunity for your clients today versus time spent looking at what's sort of coming down the pipe, what's emerging, what's new, what even is potentially just the new sort of shiny object? How do you strike the balance between those two things?
Well, I think the balance comes from focusing on the journey itself, on the thing that you're trying to accomplish from a business perspective, or from an audience perspective. But it's if you get that right, if you take the time to understand your customer, this is business 101. You understand their hopes, aspirations, dreams, concerns, fears. Understand what they're expecting from you. You know, whether you're providing products or services. Understand what it is that, you know, that kind of motivates people to make a decision to buy something from you, to engage with you. If you get all that right, and that journey starts with, you know, a whiteboard or a piece of paper, your own experiences and experiences of others, the rest kind of follows through. Then it becomes a question of, well, how do we make that happen? do we use a channel like Facebook or Twitter, or do we use a digital assistant or a chatbot? Do we use artificial intelligence and applied analytics? How do we use them? And then you know, what does that look like so that we can create an experience that people truly would appreciate?
So when we think about the future, what are the things that you are like personally most invested in or excited about? And I sort of ask this question, you can either answer it from the perspective of just, you know, things that are very personal to you or things that you think will be significant for your business, or both, it's up to you. But like, what are you really excited about at the moment?
Well, there's one area of this, which is, as we touched on earlier, it's very personal, and it touches, you know, my career, which is how do you make sure that things you're creating, all these creative and wonderful things that we are rapidly developing and deploying every day, serve humanity's interest. That philosophically is the thing that really motivates me, and you know this too, as a sort of a newish father as I am. You really, once you are a father, once you have a family, you really start thinking about these things long term. You start thinking about, I want the world to be a better place, and I don't want this to be some dystopic nightmare. I want you know, the technologies that we're using to be safe and serve the interests of my children and their children. So there's that philosophical piece that it's also around digital ethics that I find particularly fascinating, something that I try to make sure is in whatever we do day in, day out. Then there are the things that I just think are wonderful because they're creative. There's some new things. And you talked about, you know, Tim Urban and the discussions we had around artificial intelligence. It's an interesting topic. In the way he expressed it was very thoughtful and made me think about where we are in that sort of development curve and where we could be. And it that filtered back, even though we might not be all the way up on the end of his hockey stick curve at this point, we could be there pretty quickly if we're not careful. You better have a plan for it. So I kind of think all the things that I do day to day when I think about, you know, creating digital assistants is, how do we not just deploy a bunch of chatbots that because we can, but how do we make those experiences better by really focusing on what drives the questions in the first place and people's motivations to interact? And what do we do with those? Are we one and done, or are we really thinking that we need to treat these new technologies not as just technologies, but as almost entities in and of themselves before they ever, you know, even have a glimmer of artificial intelligence in the true pure sense? are these the things that we need to train, instruct, and humanize, in quotation marks, right here, right now? And I've even postulated with clients who really are excited by the prospect of using automation and machine learning and all of these kind of pre-AI ideas to interact with customers or to gain scale or to, you know, anticipate people's needs and be a digital assistant, all great. But I kind of say, you know what, we should treat these things as children, bring the father analogy back. You know, watching my children develop, it gives you a keen sense of how they learn and how to keep them on the straight and narrow and how to give them, you know, instruction on being moral. Do we need to make sure that we're doing the same thing for all the technologies we're creating? And I've even suggested that we create, you know, a digital nursery for the things now on that actually has a safe haven. It's for all the interesting and wacky ideas that you might be playing with, and chatbots are certainly part of that, but as a way to watch them and encourage them and teach them, and also instruct us on how difficult it is to make those interactions, however nascent they are in terms of their ability to mimic humans, much more thoughtful than we would have if we had simply thought about just solving the problem.
Well, if you remember at the Tim Urban Road to Super Intelligence breakfast that we hosted, Dennis Mortensen was also in attendance, and he's the founder and CEO of X.AI, and they're building, you know, AI assistants essentially to help you kind of schedule meetings. And I've been using Amy as my meeting scheduler now for 4 years or however long it's been since I was like a sort of an early beta user. But what I thought was very interesting in that conversation, and he's spoken at Social Media Week a couple of times since, that he talks about kind of who they are recruiting, like who they bring onto the team to support the, you know, the people that are building the AI. And he says the people that he's looking for and he's most interested in hiring at this point are like theater majors, because ultimately they can bring that sort of like humanistic, human first sort of sensibility to thinking about how they train AI. And I think what you're touching on is so interesting and so important, which is the kind of moral grounding that we need to establish in the kind of like the early sort of architecting of a lot of these new products and services, because if they're not grounded in the fundamentals of what it means to be human, then how they evolve essentially and develop over time is not necessarily going to be from the right point of view. And I think that just sort of speaks to something that I think is probably, like, you know, a little overlooked at times, particularly as we collectively get very giddy and excited about the next big technological innovation.
That's right. And I think it applies to not just artificially intelligent technologies or machine learning or the latest in IoT. I think it applies to everything that we do as technologists, just thinking about what's the end goal here? Like, is it to do something clever that gets the largest audience to interact, or is it to do something that drives value for people? And social is, like, you've heard me talk that when I think about social and social media, I do not think exclusively about the platforms and the technologies themselves. They abound for sure, but I think the thing that we're doing right now is social. Getting on a phone call is social, you know, meeting someone is social. And all these things are kind of the things that should be informing anything that we're doing to add a new technology layer to all of that. Because at the end of the day, the purpose of all these interactions is to be in a community, to sort of share and learn and entertain and kind of push our thinking and to build relationships that maybe we didn't have before. And that's the fundamental reason that we exist, I think. And so technologies need to kind of follow that same curve.
Well, it's interesting because, like, certain technologies, mimic or support or provide utility to kind of existing human behavior that doesn't feel particularly sort of like alien or even disruptive. You know, you're right. Like this is, you know, to a certain extent, a conversation that is social. But the big difference between the technology that's enabling this and social media and the technology that has been so pervasive and disruptive and that has created so many questions and concerns is that this is still one-to-one. Social media is many-to-many, and many-to-many is, you know, I'm stealing from Clay Shirky here, but many-to-many changes everything. And the reason it changes everything is because when you have the means to be able to create and share, then, you know, ultimately you lose the ability to be able to control the conversation or to control the message or how the message is shared or who the message is ultimately shared with. And that's what's been, I think, to a certain extent, so difficult to predict. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of this sort of idea of a lot of the conversations around unintended consequences as a result of the products that we've designed. And I'm not a fan of it because I just think it's just like such an easy out. You know, it's just a kind of a cop out. It's like an excuse. But the reality is it just means that we weren't thinking deeply enough about the actual consequences of the products that we were designing. But nevertheless, the truth is that many-to-many networked communication is just like something that we weren't prepared for in terms of ultimately how it was going to kind of like impact people's lives. And you know, now to a certain extent, you know, we are having to kind of like deal with that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, I think that's what you were mentioning earlier about, you know, having different people from different or divergent backgrounds sit side by side with people who are creating technology because they bring a unique perspective. It's not that these technologies get out of control and the law of unintended consequences takes over, and we throw up our hands and say, well, we didn't mean that, and that's what happened, and so, you know, oh, that's not our fault. Technologies, like anything else, are simply a mirror of ourselves, right? And they can be used for good or ill, and they can, they often, in particularly now, they can amplify the good and the bad. And that's the thing that kind of gets away from us very quickly, because we haven't really thought about, well, maybe we need to have a few more rules, and maybe we need to have a way of engaging that's safer. I mean, it's interesting. That's why I almost think that it's good to have not only people who might be theater majors participate, but I think psychologists and sociologists, I think they have an enormous role to play in the future in technology, because they study this, our own human behavior, and they can sort of start thinking, well, here's where we might get out of control if we don't think about this carefully. And you see it, I mean, we talk about things like cyberbullying and stuff. I don't know that we have more bullies than we've ever had in the past. I do think that people's behavior does change when on technology, right? It almost makes us feel like we're divorced from our true self, our true id, whatever. Like we can do things that maybe we wouldn't normally do if we were simply standing face to face with someone, if that makes sense.
Right. Totally. Totally. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. This has been one of my most favorite conversations. I always appreciate talking to you, Rob. You're a deep thinker. I love the historian's kind of perspective on things. I just think it sort of takes us down so many sort of fascinating different sort of pathways. So thank you again for joining us on Leads to Scale, Rob. I really appreciate it.
Oh, anytime. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Leads to Scale, a podcast from Social Media Week. Leads to Scale is edited and produced by Al Manarino. For the latest news and insights, or to learn more information about how to get involved with future Social Media Week events, please visit socialmediaweek.org.